will move to the next item. Thank you, Hans. The next item is a technical update on disclosures precisely by Alan Teixeira.
Okay, thank you. What I'll do is, Hans has already mentioned a little bit about the initiative for disclosure, and we've placed in front of you, and for people listening, they can get off our website, a copy of the disclosure feedback statement. So what I intend to do is just walk very quickly through, I guess, part of the journey of how we got to our 10-point plan, and go through just a couple of the details. This is not a technical debate, but I want to give you a flavour for the types of impediments that exist in current IFRSs that we're trying to remove. To Scott's point about making sure investors are part of the story, you'll see that as well as actually trying to clarify some issues, we are going to suggest as part of our 10-point plan adding some disclosure requirements, because we think that helps with the clarity and connectivity within the financial statements. So I'll walk through. So this is Agenda Paper 2A, and as I said, you've got the feedback statement as well. The catalyst for this, starting on the first slide, was the agenda consultation, and people said we need a disclosure framework. And I think, to put a sense in it, most people, when we develop our individual standards, are reasonably comfortable with the disclosures that go with those standards. What they're worried about is when you sit there and you look at the cumulative effect of all those individual standards, and the ability of entities, or the incentives for entities, to try and identify within those standards what the most important aspects of the business are and how to communicate. So people asked us in our agenda consultation to explore this far more than we were doing, and to develop a proper disclosure framework. Now, we initially suggested that should be done at the framework level. And we still intend to have some very high-level disclosure principles within the framework. But two things came out of that. One is, we don't want to oversell or create an expectation that we're going to create a full disclosure framework within the conceptual framework. That's not the place. We think that's better done at the standards level. And the second thing is that, as fast as we're going, you know, Hans has said it's a very aggressive timetable. We're talking about the end of 2015 before we get the framework completed. We then started on a journey to look at disclosure. We'd be looking at 2020 or thereabouts before we make some significant improvements. And so we asked whether or not it was possible to, within the context of existing IFRSs, make some changes that will actually be the catalyst for improving financial reporting disclosures more generally, without us having to wait until the framework's finished. So in the light of that, we did two things. Just before Christmas last year, we put in place a survey. It wasn't designed to be a comprehensive survey, but we're quite pleased we got 225 responses without much effort. It shows how passionate people are about this, both from preparers and users and others. And without going into too much detail, there were almost two views, and this is, I think, slide five is a little Venn diagram. The users said it's about poor communication and, to Scott's point, not enough relevant information. The repairers said it's all about overload. But there were common themes. One was there's too much generic language in there. When we talk about accounting policies, that will come to light. And the other is there's too much immaterial information. In other words, it's hard to see what's important for an organisation because there's just so much information being presented. I won't say conveyed, but actually printed or presented in financial reports. So common themes in a sense. We held a disclosure forum or discussion forum at the end of January. We had 120 people from mostly from Europe and UK, a few from outside, but clearly when you're based in London, you're going to that'll be the bias will be towards people who can get access. But we did webcast it, and we had people sitting through the night listening to the webcast for the whole time, and we gave them the chance to ask questions as well via the webcast. We started off, one of the important things is this is not new. People have been thinking about this for a long time. The FASB is doing work, EFRAG's been doing work, the European Standards Setters, the UK Board's been doing work by itself, Scottish and New Zealand Institutes did some work. Lots of people are thinking about disclosure. I think it's important is that people look to us. We're the only global organisation who can bring all this together. And so they're asking us to step up and actually do something at a global level rather than having a series of developments going on around the globe. So at the forum, I think just to summarise it very quickly in a sense, I think we got quite a consistent message there. We had a user, an analyst, presenting to us. We had a preparer, Russell Pico from HSBC. Paul Lee was the analyst. And they had a very common message, and that is preparers are actually wanting to communicate and tell a story and present their business as they think it ought to be presented. And investors want to hear that story. They want to listen to it. And they see that there are some impediments to that. Hans has already touched on a few, and Clemens, about some of the problems that are that you have to put this in there because there's a litigation risk that's going on, and it's easier to disclose. Russell described it as being the price of failure is very high. I think Hans in your speech in Amsterdam said nobody's ever been sued for disclosing something. It's usually the other way around if you miss something out. So the incentives are such that it always seems to be that there's lots and lots of information in there. And people said it was very difficult to look at a set of financial statements and to get a clear picture of what was going on sometimes for an organisation. Some very specific issues came up, though, about materiality and about some of the constraints that we have. One of the very simple examples I like to give is that there are two companies that were given as examples of good financial reporting that had kind of broken the mould. One had basically, if you look through their financial statements, you'd see it was put out in sections where the accounting policy, the income and the balance sheet items were all presented together around that particular topic. In other words, they didn't have what we would typically see as financial statements of the main primary financial statements followed by accounting policies followed by notes. So they had actually structured it in a way that they thought was the clearest communication. That's the type of thing that people say they'd like to do. But Russell Pico made a very simple comment. He said, I don't think IS1 allows us to do that, one of our standards, and I'll get to why there's a barrier there. So it seems like that people told us that some of the way we express our standards and we talk about materiality is actually getting in the way of communication between preparers and investors. So we took that on board, and what we decided is a plan that Hans set out in a speech in Amsterdam. Essentially, some short-term initiatives and then some longer-term initiatives. So the short-term initiatives are, I think of that in terms of two specific items. One is having a look at our current standard IS1, which basically sets out the structure for financial statements, talks about accounting policies and so on. And I'll give you two little issues, and these are illustrative of the types of things we're addressing. One is on the presentation order. One of the paragraphs, and I used to know, I could quote the number, but I've forgotten the number now, I think it's 23, something like that, says that the normal order of presentation of the notes to the financial statements is as follows, colon, and then it goes, the accounting policies, and then the next line it says, the supplementary notes or explanatory notes presented in the same order as the items in the balance sheet and income statement. And that means that you've got a bank, for example, that's going to have its financial instruments and then perhaps its property, plant and equipment. And a chemical company, it's going to have financial instruments and property, plant and equipment, where in fact it could be the importance is actually switched. And so people are looking at that and saying, if it's normal that that's the way it needs to be presented, I'm prevented from presenting it in any other way. And so we're going to look at amending that and taking away that what we see as being an inhibitor to people having a bit more flexibility about presenting. Now, it is a difficult issue, and we're going to have to see what feedback we get, because some of the feedback that we heard through Europe in particular is they like that standard order because it's easier to find things. They always know that, you know, note number 6 is property, plant and equipment, for example. But we think the overwhelming message was it's an inhibitor to good communication. One of the other issues is accounting policies. Within IS1, it says that you should present significant accounting policies. And so most people looking at that would think that those are the policies that are important to an entity. But if you look through now, most businesses would have 6 or 7 pages of accounting policies. One of the presenters at the forum told us they could tell who the auditors were of particular companies because these auditors have model financial statements, and these companies would copy those accounting policy descriptions into there. They do an excellent job, basically, of summarising our requirements in the IFRSs. In other words, they were very generic. and you couldn't tell on the six pages which ones were important or not. Again, we talked about how we can break that mold, and one of the possibilities is to talk about identifying the most significant policies up front in it, or in relation to, you could present them with the other explanatory notes. And any other, I'll call them boilerplate policies or generic policies, you might relegate to the back of the financial statements, and being able to, in a sense, give people permission to do that. And the type of thing with IAS 1, again, going back to down to a technical level, there's a sentence in there that says you should only present significant policies. And then it says, it goes on to say, for example, if a company pays taxation, we expect to see the policy for tax. There is no discretion about what your accounting policy is for tax. It's a very generic approach in IAS 12. And so anybody reading that would say, well, if I pay tax and I have to put my policy, I've got revenue, I've got to put a policy, there must be a policy for everything in there. So we see that as being, again, encouraging generic presentation of policies and not getting down to the core of what's really important to me. Those are the types of changes we're going to make. One of the other sort of related short-term, Hans mentioned drafting. The two types of examples we have where people feel uncomfortable is we do have a statement in IAS 1 that says you don't have to disclose something if it's not material. It's a very generic statement. Then they'll go and read an accounting standard that says it'll provide a nice clear objective for what the standard's trying to achieve. And then it'll say, to meet that objective, an entity shall disclose the following, and then we'll list them. And people tell us it's very hard to argue that quite a generic statement that you don't have to disclose something material can override a standard where it says an entity shall disclose. And in particular, we have one standard, and I think it's IFRS 2, where it says an entity shall disclose at a minimum, colon, and then lists. It's very hard to argue that, again, a generic materiality override can override something as specific as that. We have to be careful, because when we developed IFRS 2, which is about share-based payments and any standard, we developed those disclosure requirements hand-in-hand with how we thought about recognition and measurement. So we don't just want to do, as some have suggested, just cross out, you have to disclose those things. We have to think about this carefully. But we certainly want to make sure that we don't create disclosure requirements that imply a checklist approach. So for new standards, we've actually started to modify the wording a little bit to talk about the types of information an entity should consider disclosing to meet the objective. And so it's slightly less prescriptive, and we're going to see if that changes behaviour a bit. So in the short term, there are some little fixes there. It's not just about taking things away. In one case, we're going to suggest is a thing that investors have been asked for a net debt reconciliation for quite a long time. So we're going to take a proposal to the board to potentially add that as a requirement as well. And that's a case where people are looking at financial statements to see bits and pieces and can't connect those pieces together. And a net debt reconciliation is one that actually provides connectivity between those. Again, it's a direct response to a call from investors that came through the agenda consultation loud and clear. The other shorter term one is on materiality, and we have to be very careful about the way we proceed with that, because materiality, as some comments come back already, it's used by regulators and others. People have a different sense of materiality. We will work with the auditing community and the regulators to see the extent to which we should develop education material, or whether that's something that they should develop education material. But we know that materiality is very critical to this. So our short-term changes are not about changing what materiality is. We're hoping that we're going to give a little more freedom to people to be able to tell a story, but it's going to take a medium term before we actually look at any potential changes to how we express materiality. Now, in the longer term, we've talked about disclosure framework. Some trustees will recall we had a financial statement presentation project that we put on hold in about 2010, I think. We were very close to an exposure draft at that stage. A lot of good thinking went on in there, but we're going to basically look to see whether or not we should take our core presentation standards. I'll quote the numbers IAS 1, 7 and 8, but they're essentially what your income statement looks like, your balance sheet and your cash flow statement, and then accounting policies and comparability and things like that, whether we should replace those with one generic standard that really looks at disclosure generally, and that would essentially be a disclosure framework. We could wait until we finish our conceptual framework work, but we think we should start there now. And essentially that will move on to our research agenda, so we start to do a lot of the thinking, so we're ready to go once we finish the framework. And in a way, that's a chance for us to step back and review all of the standards together as well, and see whether there's some way that we can make it more helpful to people to look at the whole picture, rather than just focusing on standard-by-standard disclosures. So there's a lot of work to do, but we're starting with short-term things. We are, for example, in September taking our first papers to the board to look at changes to our IS1. So you'll see quite quick action in there. And that's direct response to the feedback we had, both agenda consultation and disclosure forum. So I'm not sure if there are any questions or about that.
Thank you, Alan, for this comprehensive presentation. I see Harvey and Heidi.
Alan, that was an excellent presentation, and this is an immensely important set of projects on disclosure. Just a note of caution, since I spent a meaningful part of my professional life dealing with disclosure and materiality, it is very difficult. As you fly at 30,000 or 40,000 feet, it's easy for preparers to worry about overload, want bright lines, want certainty, and one understands that. It's just as important for regulators and investors to worry about not losing really important information, as you and Hans have been saying. But don't think for a minute this will be easy water. As I think you understand, in the U.S., lawyers think of this as their special area. I did a piece at the SEC when I was general counsel called Staff Accounting Bulletin 99, where I tried to tell the world everything I knew about materiality in about 110 pages. And I'm not sure it finished the debate. this, as I say, is the project I fully support, but there has to be a note of caution and concern, and if ever due process is important, it's in this area, to keep reaching out and getting responses and getting thoughts, both from investors and the regulatory community.
Thank you, Harvey. Any comments on that? No? Heidi?
Harvey, this is a really important topic. I can't tell you how many times, sitting around audit committees, we talk about materiality in the context of what it means for the company. And with oftentimes preparers saying, well, it's not material now, we'll worry about it next quarter. And I think it's just that sort of passage of time issue that's the hardest to grapple with. At what point do you determine you should give that concern out there to your investor? I'm also a little concerned about one meeting in one area of the world, and even though you had outreach and a webcast, I think somebody staying up in the middle of the night to listen and participate perhaps might be supplemented by meetings elsewhere in the world with different sets of companies, etc. So I do think that geography informs concepts of materiality as well, and you might be advised to think about that.
Thank you. Alan, you want to comment?
No. These comments are both welcome and not unexpected, because we have been, there are Supreme Court judgments on materiality, and so we're quite aware that it's an area to tread quite carefully in. One of the things we did talk about, we are going to make sure we're involved in the international community, both auditing and securities regulators as well. So, and we started steps in that direction.
Aki?
The one question I have is you are going to attack the materiality. Definition is very important. But are you going to cover qualitative nature of materiality or quantitative nature of materiality? That is my first question. Then, materiality judgment depends on the preparer, corporation, as well as auditors. How do you determine which area is auditor judgment or company judgment, which area is accounting standard setter judgment?
First of all, I don't want to answer that question directly because I think the first phase of our materiality issue is to find out the nature of the problem and why we're getting potentially different judgments. But I will go a little bit further than that in terms of my personal view is it's mainly qualitative things and that you're looking at. We already have, for example, I would consider it to be application guidance on materiality in relation to related party transactions. In other words, we explain in one of our standards that if you're dealing with parties that are related to you in some way, that maybe that's something that is more important to investors or the people reading it, because there could be some influences because of that relationship. So in a sense, that's putting an overlay on materiality. You know, I sort of tongue-in-cheek say, you know, bribes, if you're paying bribes to somebody, it's not a quantitative assessment. I think that's probably a pretty strong qualitative assessment. The last thing we want to do is to start to develop a whole series of mechanical, this is what materiality means. We need to understand the problem much more carefully before we start to take that journey.
Yes, Ian.
Oh,
sure.
I take Aki's point, and I often think in terms of disclosures, a much better word is relevance, because I think materiality gets caught up in a whole lot of history and in other areas of judgment as well. And it just seems to me what we want really is relevant disclosure, you know, and that involves materiality, but it's sort of a more of a qualitative judgment as well.
Other comments? Well, thank you, Alan. We then move to the next and last item on the agenda, which is the report of the Chair of the Due Process Oversight Committee, Scott Evans. Yeah.